Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. And as always, I'm so glad that you can join me here on the program as we go into the old collection of baseball cards once again. And we've got an interesting show for you today, as we didn't quite expect this show to turn out the way it did. Of course, if I was totally honest, that's pretty much every show. Yet somehow we're still out there and people still keep listening. No, I have to liken today's show to that unexpected hit at the box office. Has this ever happened to you? Have you ever gone out to a movie that you weren't planning on going to, and you didn't even pick which movie to watch? You let a friend do it. And this is probably something that goes back to your high school or your college days. You're just looking for something to do. And your friend says, hey, let's go see this movie. And you go, okay. You know, like you had really no drive or desire to see that specific movie, but you're looking for something fun to do. And your friend says, let's go do this. And you go out and you do it. And you watch the movie and you have such a good time. You leave the movie theater and you think, that was really fun. I'm glad I did that. That was pretty neat. I'm really glad that my friend suggested we go out to this movie. That is pretty much the feeling that I had with the main topic of this week's show, which is not a collector favorite, mostly because of the year it was released. However, as has often been the case with this program, when you take a second look at some sets, especially from the junk wax era, you have a whole new appreciation for it. And I have a whole new appreciation for the 1991 Fleer Ultra set because I had a friend suggest that I open it. Actually, I had several friends, as in you, the listener, as by popular demand. This is something we did a few weeks ago. After I went to the local card show slash flea market and I bought some just junk wax era boxes, for just a few dollars a piece, I put four of them up on Twitter and I said, okay, pick one and we'll open up a few packs and talk about that on the show. Well, a few weeks ago, you selected the 1992 Upper Deck box. So we had a nice little chat about that and, you know, went ripping through some packs and, had a good time going through some old school Upper Deck, you know, the last quote unquote classic Upper Deck set before they raised their game to keep up with the competition starting in 1993. And, we had some pretty good feedback about that. So I figured, well, I still have these three other boxes. Plus, I just purchased a box of 91 Fleer Ultra at that same, or not that same card show. It was a month later. It's a monthly show here in Tampa that I go to. And I bought this box of Fleer Ultra for $5. And actually, it was less than that. It was $4.50 because the dealer that I got these from, and it's the same guy who I got the 92 Upper Deck and the other boxes from, he's just clearing out his garage. So he has boxes and boxes of these. He's selling them 2 for $9. So again, like we did with the 92 Upper Deck box a few weeks ago, like we did with the 92 Tops box a few months ago, it's one of those, why not? it's $4.50 for a box of cards. And they were in great shape. You know, they were probably just sitting in a case, sitting in his garage, and they've been taped up for 28 years, just begging to be opened, and here was the chance. So I pick up a box, and basically, I just added it to the collection of the three other boxes, and we put it up for a poll. And surprisingly, the Fleer Ultra box won. Now, to be upfront, we didn't have a whole lot of voters in this poll. So if you don't like 91 Fleer Ultra, or you don't like this particular main topic of this show, it's all your fault because you should have voted and changed the outcome. But I'm glad that 91 Fleer Ultra won because after opening up the entire box, I realized how much of a nice set it is. And because there's not a whole lot of repetition within the packs, that is a set that I may, when I get a little more free time later on in the summer, will probably turn into a hand-collated set, and it'll now sit in a box in my possession for 28 years before I do anything with it. But it was such a pleasurable opening that I'm really glad that our listeners selected it. And the FLIR Ultra Box won with 41% of the vote. Coming in at second place, the 93 Topps Stadium Club Series 1. That got 29%. 92 FLIR got 26%. And then the 93 Topps Stadium Club Series 2 got the remainder. I think it was like 4% of the vote there. So this was the unexpected surprise. I really enjoyed opening this box. I enjoyed looking back at this set. And we'll talk a little bit about the FLIR Ultra set. We'll talk about the shortcomings that the set had, and it did have quite a few. Some of them by pure circumstance, just bad timing. The hobby was blowing up big time. The bar was set really high by some of the competition. And then some of it, too, by FLIR's own mismanagement. 1991 was not a very good year for FLIR. They had a disaster of a base set. They were still producing a good but not great card, and the hobby was shifting towards great cards in base sets plus premium sets. And also, FLIR made some very odd decisions in the choices of the cards of the players, leaving out a couple of key rookies, including Juan Gonzalez, which was a head scratcher back then, and still all these years later, you're wondering, well, how did they leave him out? Because by 1991, going into the 1991 season, there was no doubt that Gonzalez was going to be a top player in the league and certainly a hot buy for rookie card enthusiasts, as had already been proven with his rookie cards in other sets. And it wasn't just Juan Gonzalez. Jeff Bagwell was also notoriously missing from that set. And there were a lot of indications going into the 1991 season that Bagwell was going to be a big rookie card that was sought after, that he was going to have a promising start to his major league career. Of course, he certainly did. But while Bagwell was included in a lot of other sets, for some strange reason, FLIR Ultra left him out. So we'll talk about that and the hobby in general and the premium sets that popped up in 1991, some winners and losers in a little bit. But first, let's reset the table as we like to do every now and then. We come your way every other Friday now, and that means that our next show will be Friday, May the 10th, so a couple weeks from now. And I've got an idea for a particular topic for that show. I am hoping to reach out to a guest related to that topic. I don't know if I can get in contact with this person because they are a little elusive, but that's the tease I'm going to leave there now. But even if I don't get this particular person on the line, I do believe I will be talking about an interesting set and story from the late 1970s. So stay tuned for that. That's the plan that I have for now for that next show. And you can listen to Wax Ecstatic via Audio Boom. That is our home base, but it's also distributed through multiple platforms. Our main channels are iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, Google Play, and Spotify, but any of the companies that basically snatch RSS feeds and send them out there, you can listen to us that way. You can also follow us on Twitter, at Wax and Gum Stains. That is our handle, and the conversation is open 24/7 there. And we always welcome your questions, your comments, your thoughts, not just about the sets we talk about or the players we talk about, but also just the hobby in general. So any commentary you have, you're always more than welcome to bring it to Wax and Gum Stains. We'll actually answer a couple questions from that timeline in just a moment. Also, if you would like to keep Wax Ecstatic going strong, you can do so by making a cash donation to our PayPal account. That's paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, paypal.me/waxecstatic. And as always, I thank everyone who has made a donation. We don't ask for much. It can be as little as $2 or $5, or in a lot of cases, it's $20, $25. That goes a long, long way in keeping not only the program fresh in terms of we're able to take that money and go out and buy the product that we either open up or that we share with you on the program here, but also we are able to maintain the archive. We've got over 125 episodes, and also we pay our dues into Audio Boom for hosting this. And, you know, there's also a little bit of labor of love here on my part. I'm working hard to put the show together in my spare time, and these shows don't just magically appear. It does take a few hours to put together, so I'm always appreciative, even if it's just a few dollars. It doesn't go into my pocket and doesn't go into my kids' mouths or their college fund. It goes right back into the program. Again, either the maintenance of the main site in the archive or through the purchase of the products that we get to talk about on this program. And also, please know, any excess product that I have, and I'll take the 92 Upper Deck box, for example, from a few weeks ago. We opened it up, had over 500 cards. We looked through them, talked about them. What I do with that excess product is put them in a box and then send them off to one of two charities, which will then, or I shouldn't say charities, one of two groups who do charitable work, shall we say, in redistributing these cards to children. One is Cards for Kids, the other is Kidority Cards, and I do that every few months. And basically just put these cards together, spend the $20 to ship them out, and then they go to both of those organizations. Cards for Kids will put together donation packages and send these cards out to hospitals and schools so that kids can just experience baseball cards for free. And Kidority Cards, which we did a podcast on several months ago, they will take these cards and group them into team sets. And for a small fee, you can have your child receive a monthly package of cards related to his or her favorite team. So for me, it's not only these vintage cards or these junk wax cards, as the case may be. Some of them are from my personal collection. Every now and then I go through my own collection. You know, I put in some duplicates of new cards that I have, including like the new Topps Heritage or the new Topps base set. If I've got dupes, they end up in these boxes as well. So know that even if your money goes to the purchase of product, it's not like I'm just massively hoarding these cards because, first of all, my wife would kick me out of the house. Second, I really have no desire to continue adding to the junk wax collection that I started as a teenager many, many years ago. So know that the money that you donate is not only going to the maintenance of the program, not only going to the purchase of the cards that we talk about, but in all cases, the excess cards from some of these purchases are basically, for lack of a better term, recycled. I prefer to use repurposed and regifted to children, whether it's through Cards for Kids, through the, you know, the careful organization and the cards to charities and nonprofit organizations, or through Kidority Cards, where they do a great job of collecting these cards and distributing them to kids through a subscription service, but it helps get children more involved in the hobby and the sport, and that is always a good thing. So know that even in the short term and the long term, your money is going a very long way. Again, that's paypal.me/waxecstatic, the best way to get those donations in. Now, as I said, there were a couple of questions on our, or comments, I should say, on our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains I wanted to get to. One comes from Topps Pursuit, who mentions that he's gotten back into the hobby after a 28-year hiatus. Well, welcome back. It is fun to come back, and I know it can be a little overwhelming too, so purchase accordingly. But for a lot of us who came back after a hiatus, for me it wasn't 28 years. For me it was about, maybe 10, 12 years. And that's just with new product. I always have my hands on vintage cards, but, you know, before I really got back into it, it was a while, like many of our listeners here. You know, you get away from it for a few years and then you come back and you rediscover the passion. So I hope that you're getting back into the game and having a good time doing it. you mentioned the last episode about 77 Tops and our focus on the airbrushing efforts of Tops and the challenges that they have with airbrushing for two reasons. One, the expansion teams, the Mariners and the Blue Jays coming into the league in 77, but also free agency. The offseason of 76 into 77 was the first year of unrestricted free agency. So there were quite a few cards in the 77 set that had to be airbrushed, and Topps was really on its toes for a time period of about 4 months doing that to roll out that set on time. And Topps Pursuit says, really enjoyed the most recent episode and all the airbrush madness of the 77 Topps set. Got me thinking about what the last card ever to be airbrushed might have been. Probably isn't knowable, but it's fun to think about the swan song of the art form. I don't know if there is a definitive answer. I would leave that up to the scholars of baseball cards, but even Topps Pursuit suggested Francisco Cabrera's 90 Topps card might have been the last one. Certainly there were a few cards in the late 80s. The one that comes to my mind instantly is Rick Honeycutt, whose 88 Topps card was laughably airbrushed. It was not a very good airbrushing job. But also, you know, there were a couple cards in 89, and you mentioned 1990. I think 90 would have been the last year for airbrushing. I do not recall a 1991 Topps card that was airbrushed. And in fact, I think there was a player or two who was traded right before the 91 season. And instead of airbrushing the card, Topps just put in the lower corner, now with such and such team. I think that was the 91 Topps set. But again, to the best of my recollection, 1991, there were no airbrushed cards in the base set. And even by then, Topps was going with, you know, if there was a high school draft pick, if there was a top college draft pick, you know, you had pictures of the player in his high school or college uniform, and they didn't worry about airbrushing out any logos or anything. So by the early 90s, Topps had given it up. And there's a couple of reasons. One is that with technology, first of all, in computer technology with photography, it was a lot easier to doctor a picture, or the terminology we use for today is Photoshop. You know, that's where a brand name becomes kind of the mainline term for a process, you know, much like Xerox. You know, Xerox is a brand name, but, you know, everyone calls a photocopy a Xerox. Likewise, touching up on a photo is now just generically called a Photoshop. And that was something that became more of a realistic and inexpensive option for card companies to do starting in the late 80s. In fact, the legendary 89 Upper Deck Ken Griffey Jr., as many hobbyists found out just a few years ago, was actually a photographed or a photoshopped card of a minor league photograph of him. And it's a fascinating story if you go look for it. Again, it came out probably about 5 years ago, I think the story came out, about how Upper Deck selected this particular minor league headshot, how they were able to doctor the card to where it looked like he was wearing a Seattle Mariners uniform and not a Bellingham Mariners uniform, and how and why they selected that card to be the first card of their first set. So the photoshopping process, if you will, was already well in place in the hobby. Upper Deck was able to make good use of the technology. Topps still airbrushed here and there for a couple of cards, but even by 1991 or 92, they were able to find ways to get around the old-fashioned airbrushing and at least use some Photoshop-esque programs to change up a player's uniform or hat if necessary. But also, because of the technology upgrades in the printing of the cards, what used to be a weeks-long process of design, layout, printing, and cutting, and collating into packs and sets, and you name it, became a more efficient operation in the early 1990s. So the turnaround time was a lot shorter. So if you had a late addition, if your set rolled out, let's say on March 15th, if you had a player change in late January, you could make that last second change, even if it was something as simple as putting text on the card that said, now playing for such and such team, and then just changing the logo on the card. You could do that without disrupting the card run. And one last thought, too, is that the hobby was changing starting in 1991, and you would see it in effect in the 92 and 93 sets. But after Topps went to the one release set, the one series set in 1974, collectors started demanding multi-series sets once again, and the companies happily obliged because you could now release cards with special short print runs, special inserts in these additional series. So it started with Donruss in 1991. They went to a two-series set, and then other card companies would latch on to it pretty quickly in 1992. Topps went back to the multi-series set in 1993. So basically what you could do is you could hold off on those big name changes, or especially in the sense of 1993 with the addition of the Rockies and Marlins, you could hold off for those expansion card pictures until the second series. So there are a few things that play into that. Again, the Photoshop technology, the production technology of the cards themselves, the printing and the assortment and the distribution of those cards, and then just the hobby changing, getting away from the one series release into the multi-series release in the early to mid-90s. That is what was ultimately the death knell of what is kind of a kitschy part of baseball card history. But again, my airbrushed hat is tipped to the Topps art department specifically in 1977, because they did have their hands full with the expansion and with the free agency. Another great comment from Brian Kilby in regards to our selection of 91 Fleer Ultra to discuss this week. He says, I grew up dirt poor. I was 12 in 1991. I should have realized that given my family's low income and the relatively huge collection of Fleer Ultra cards that I had at the time, that this was not the financial investment that I had convinced myself that it would be. Well, Brian, you are not alone. There are a lot of people who 25, 30 years ago invested in baseball cards thinking it would make them filthy rich. But like any other investment bubble, that was not the case. In fact, there are a lot of people who collected, nay, hoarded 1989 Upper Deck Ken Griffey Jr. cards and unopened 89 Upper Deck boxes and sets. And they thought that, well, if we store these away, we can sell these off and make millions of dollars. And while the Upper Deck Griffey card from that year and the premier edition of Upper Deck is still very valuable these days, it is certainly not buying anybody any mansions. So that was one of the reasons why it was so easy to part with so many of my cards, because I looked at these, I'm like, well, I've got a lot of wonderful memories of collecting these cards, but what the hell am I going to do with, 10,000 or 12,000 of these 91 Donruss and 89 Score and, all those other cards that I had? So I know that 91 Fleer Ultra, and in fact, a lot of these junk wax era cards, brings a little bit of heartburn to some collectors because you think back to some, shall we say, poor financial choices in collecting cards back in the day. But it happens. And, for me, it was 89 Score. 88 Topps is another set. But, I've shared the story in past episodes where likewise, around the age of 12, 13, I wasn't dirt poor. My family actually was, you know, pretty good middle class, upper middle class family, living in suburbia in the late 80s and early 90s. My parents worked very hard for me and my brothers. But, you know, I personally didn't have a whole lot of disposable income. And this was before I was raking in some money by mowing the neighbor's yard. I would pick up a few dollars here and there. So when I went to a card store, I had to be very selective of my purchases. And because opening packs was my thing, I couldn't afford the more expensive packs at the time. I couldn't afford the Upper Decks. So, you know, if I wanted new stuff, I often bought the Donruss or the Bowman or the Topps. And if I wanted older cards, you know, I ended up buying the 88 Topps packs or the 89 Score packs. And that's what caused a little bit of derision in me, to where for many, many years, I didn't even want to look at an 88 Topps card or look at 89 Score, because I remember buying those in bunches because that's what I could afford. And I had fun doing it. It was neat to collect them. But again, many years later, you're staring at a 900 count box of 90 Donruss going, well, now what? So I feel your pain. I completely agree with you. You know, you get some mild headaches and nausea when thinking back to some of these sets that you spent a ton of money on. But as we'll discuss with 91 Fleer Ultra, one of the fun things about doing this podcast is when you take a second look at some of these sets, you gain an appreciation for some of the sets that are commonly overlooked because they are from the junk wax era, but they're actually pretty decent. Fleer Ultra is one of those. 88 Topps is one too. I have finally, 30 years later, have come around to accepting 88 Topps as a pretty decent set. Not great. Certainly, you know, didn't hold a candle to the 87 Topps, which is legendary. But 88 Topps is a pretty good set, and I've actually come around to it, and I'm, you know, putting together a hand-collated set just for my own purposes. It's going to stay in my collection. 89 Score, however, that's garbage. I'm not going out of my way to collect that stuff again. So while we're talking about 91 Fleer Ultra and the angina that it creates, let's go ahead and discuss that a little bit here. As 91 Fleer Ultra, a set that was doomed from the very beginning, and again, partially because of Fleer's own mistakes and partially because of just where the hobby was. But I can tell you, you can get these boxes dirt cheap. Mine was $4.50 at a card show. Yours, I looked online, you could buy one off eBay. If you include shipping, you're looking at like $12. So they're out there. And as I've said before, you will not make a card store owner or a card seller at a show or a flea market happier than if you take some junk wax off his or her hands. They will gladly unload it on you for just a few dollars, not because they're making profit off of it, but because they get it out of their garage or they get it out of their storage area. They are more than happy to hand it off to you at pennies on the dollar. And as I mentioned, you know, picked this up. This was part of a $2 for $9 purchase that I made. And it was one of those, well, why not? And when it was selected, I was just like, okay, this will be interesting. And when I opened it up, I actually had a lot of fun looking at it. So we're going to treat this set like we did the 92 Upper Deck box a few weeks ago. I opened up four packs, and it was on our video break, which we posted yesterday on our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains. If you didn't see it, you could just go into YouTube, type Wax Ecstatic 1991 Fleer Ultra Break, and you'll get the link to it. And it was a lot of fun opening it up because as I went through these packs, it dawned on me, you know, even in 1991, I didn't collect a lot of these cards. I have my own picks, but in 91, I just did not buy a lot of Fleer Ultra. And that's too bad because, again, it was a pretty decent set there. But, you know, we opened up the four packs. I've selected one card from each pack, and we'll talk about these four particular players some very interesting stories and a couple of players that were overlooked too, that kind of get lost in the shuffle over the hands of time, but some players that we pulled from these packs that weren't the star players, but some players that definitely stood out when I went back through these and went, okay, this will be an interesting guy to talk about. So we'll do that at the end of the podcast. But like I was saying, in 1991, I didn't buy a lot of Fleer Ultra, and I think there's a couple reasons for that. One is I didn't buy a lot of Fleer because, as we all know, the 91 Fleer set was an absolute train wreck. Some people call it the worst set Fleer put out. Some people call it the worst set ever in baseball cards. If you say that, I would like to introduce you to the 1982 Fleer set, which was an absolute disaster. I will always put 82 Fleer above 91 Fleer as the worst cards in not only Fleer history, but baseball card history. They are definitely up there. So that's one reason. The other reason why, and I was thinking of this yesterday when I was kind of putting my thoughts together on the podcast, you know, 1991 was the bloated year of baseball cards. And the best way that I can describe 1991, and if you were collecting back then, I think you'll agree with me on this. 1991 was the year that baseball cards went from growth spurt to husky pants. Remember husky pants? I don't think they sell them like that anymore. You know, nowadays, if you go out and you buy blue jeans, you've got regular fit, you've got boot cut, you've got relaxed fit, you've got designer. Yeah, there are so many different flavors of blue jeans. Well, back in the 80s and 90s, and even before then, really, you had designer blue jeans, you had regular blue jeans, and then you had husky. And husky was a rather, I don't even want to say nice, it was a rather euphemistic way of saying fat. If you were chunky, you wore the husky jeans. This is the best way I can describe the hobby in 1991. You had the growth spurt throughout the 1980s, and you started getting a little bit of flab in 89 and 90, and then too many potato chips and dip. Time for the husky jeans. 1991 was the year of husky jeans in baseball cards. You not only had the base sets, first of all, too many of them. You had Topps, you had Fleer, you had Donruss, you had Upper Deck, you had Bowman, you had Score. Let's talk about 91 Score, the huskiest of husky jeans. 91 Score was the fat kid that wore the t-shirt that said, "I'm not fat, I'm big boned." You know that kid. You were probably that kid. But you know that kid that wore that shirt and you went, "Oh, come on, you're just fat. Get over it." 91 Score, with its 900 cards and its three series and its very 1991 color design, it was just, it's like the epitome of 1991 baseball cards was Score. Fat, bloated, tacky looking. It was proudly wearing that shirt that said, "I'm not fat, I'm big boned." Then you had more flab. You had the premium sets. You had Stadium Club. You had Leaf. You had Donruss Elite. You had Fleer Ultra. You had glossy cards coming in. You had special inserts coming in. You're chasing Reggie Jackson autograph cards in Upper Deck. You've got the chase going on. You're looking for rookie cards. Oh, speaking of rookies, you've got the 91 Donruss rookie set, which has been around for a while, but you not only have rookie set, you've got Fleer update, you've got Topps traded. There's just so much. And then on top of that, talk about more flab. You now have everybody getting in on the baseball card craze. So you've got, you know, your usual baseball card contributors such as Post Cereal and Hostess Twinkies and Burger King and Coca-Cola and Cracker Jack. But now everybody's getting it. You know, Purina Dog Chow, I think it was making baseball cards. And I still have it, you know, that card of, you know, Will Clark and his dog. Yeah, you know, everybody was creating sports cards at the time. So it was just too much. So to bring it all back to 91 Fleer Ultra and why I didn't buy it back then was there were so many options. It was just this explosion of cards that you could only, me, you know, at the time being 13 going on 14 when the 91 baseball cards came out, I only had so much money, I only had so much time, I only had so many options that Fleer Ultra just got overlooked. So, you know, in 1991, when I think back to it, I collected a lot of Topps, loved the Topps set back then, still do. I collected 91 Donruss, which even though it had the tacky Christmas sweater design, I liked it for some strange reason. Upper Deck was also a big collector's card for me. I started making some more money, so I was able to afford those packs. And 91 Bowman as well. I loved the 91 Bowman set and still do that. Of course, the year that Bowman started turning the corner from this just kind of second-rate card into the card of the rookie card collector. So Fleer Ultra just went totally under the radar for me. And I think that's part of the reason why when I was opening these cards, I had a whole new respect for the Fleer Ultra set because I didn't have very high expectations. In fact, when I first did a podcast on Fleer Ultra a couple years ago when I was going through the big monster box, I only had like 5 or 6 of these cards, so I didn't really have much of a background behind it. But opening up this box, it was kind of an eye-opening experience for me. And like I said before, I'm actually thinking of taking these cards and putting together a set. And it'll be relatively easy to do because it's only a 400-card set. And I think it'll be a nice little set just to have for the heck of it, because I'm certainly not going to be paying off any bills with the 91 Fleer Ultra set. But when Fleer Ultra was released, it was doomed from the start, as I mentioned, not only the flop of a base set that Fleer had, but as everyone else was rolling out premium sets in 1991, Fleer botched this one. First of all, they were going to call it Fleer Elite, but then Donruss had an elite set that was coming out. So Fleer had to double back. Oops. All right. What's not elite? Ultra. There we go. Ultra. Sounds like a bleach. It sounds like, you know, Mr. Clean, Ultra, you know, get those hard to remove stains off with Ultra. And, you know, Fleer tried to add a little muscle by calling it Ultra. So, you know, they had to do a little bit of a redesign with that. But then when it came out, it was a good set, but it didn't match up well against the other premium sets. And it got me to thinking back to some of the premium sets of 1991. Which were the best ones? In my opinion, by far, the Topps Stadium Club. Not only was it the best premium set, but as I've said time and time again, really reset the bar for baseball cards after Upper Deck did it in 89. Stadium Club, by a mile, in my opinion, the best premium set of 1991. Then you had Leaf, which actually, when you look at Leaf and Fleer Ultra, very similar cards. But Leaf had a little bit of a better rollout in 1990, and people kind of knew what to expect when Leaf came up with their 1991 set. So you had 91 Leaf, which was good but not great, but you know had a pretty decent presence already. Let's see, who else did you have in 1991? Let's see, Donruss Elite. Like I said, I wasn't a big collector in Donruss Elite. You would eventually have the Leaf Studio set, but that wasn't until I think 92. And let's see, Upper Deck, even though it was a base set, you know, the bar was still set high with their quality efforts. You would also eventually have Pinnacle. Score Select would come around. But, you know, those, they pale in comparison to what I recall from Stadium Club, setting the bar, setting it so high that it wasn't just premium sets, but all, everybody else had to, you know, catch up to Stadium Club, including Upper Deck. And then I think the field leveled out quite a bit. A lot of cards were looking very similar in assets in terms of set size and UV coating and inserts and stuff like that by 1993. So, you know, keeping in mind that Stadium Club was the gold standard, that Upper Deck was still, the incumbent in terms of high quality cards. And Leaf had, you know, a good set in 1990. They had a really nice set in 1991. Remembering that that is where the bar was set across the premium and upper end product, FLIR Ultra didn't match those. FLIR Ultra had a very nice design, had really good photography, had a beautiful, colorful backs, a lot of photography. But because it wasn't Stadium Club, because it wasn't Upper Deck, and it wasn't even Leaf, a lot of collectors, when the set rolled out, totally poo-pooed it. They just went, what is this? This is just not that good. And that's a shame, because again, when you look at the set individually now, you go, this is actually a pretty decent set. I think the one knock that I have on the design of FLIR Ultra in 1991 was the inclusion of the logo on the front of the card, the FLIR Ultra logo, was very clunky. It's a little bigger than it should be. It kind of obstructs some of the photography. And if you're going to use a logo, it's got to be a team logo. You know, team logos always find a way to fit in to the front of a baseball card. But the FLIR Ultra logo, I think FLIR was just so dead set on, you know, putting their stamp on the card that it really distracted from it. I think that's really the only downside. But like I said, the overall design was nice. It was very similar to what Leaf rolled out. The photography was sharp, crisp. You got some great action shots in there. The backs are colorful. There's a lot of pictures on the back of the card. You would have kind of a standalone shot, not a headshot necessarily or a mugshot, but, you know, kind of a non-action shot, bookended by two action shots. Limited stats. You only had the 1990 performance and the career stat line for the player. So, you know, if you're a numbers person, you probably prefer a little more than that. But the design is actually pretty good. The problem was it just didn't match up to what Stadium Club and the others were putting out. FLIR Ultra also had the Ultra Team subset, which is commonly referred to as Ultra Gold because they are prominently gold colored, not the foil gold that you would see in sets starting in 1992. But, you know, gold was the color that, you know, denoted that this was a special card. And basically what they did with the Ultra cards was they took the back of the base card and made it the front. So you had this, you know, three picture collage. And on the back, you had a little bit of narrative about the player's performance and why this was a gold player. So you had, for example, we pulled a Kirby Puckett gold card from the four packs that we opened. In other packs that I opened, Ken Griffey Jr., Barry Bonds, you've got some quality names in this 10-card subset. But the knock was, well, if FLIR made the Ultra Team or the Ultra Gold card, that design, the design for the base cards in the set, it would be a more popular set, which, I mean, you could argue yes or no. I'm not so sure about that now, but I think back in the early 90s, they were looking for more glitz and glamour, and that's what the gold set provided, not necessarily the base set. So I could see that argument. And then the other mysterious thing, as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, was the selection of rookies. FLIR Ultra, despite the fact that Juan Gonzalez and Jeff Bagwell were pretty much slam dunks in the rookie card and prospect chase that so many collectors were involved in the early 90s, for whatever reason, FLIR did not include those two players in this set. Now, they did feature some other young stars, Chuck Knoblauch, Mo Vaughn. Of course, you know, hindsight being 2020, those two players' careers did not quite match up to what you saw in terms of statistics from Bagwell and Gonzalez. But after that, it was just a, you know, I jokingly refer to it as the rated rookie, you know, the Fleer Ultra top prospect crop in 1991 was very Donruss rated rookie-esque in terms of many more misses than hits. So the Fleer Ultra set in 1991, even though I thought it was a good effort, it just, you know, it didn't help that the Fleer base set was such a mess. It didn't help that the other premium sets were so much better. And it didn't help that Fleer shot themselves in the foot with a lackadaisical approach to the rookie and prospect cards, even though that's really not the main factor. But again, rewinding to 1991, so many people were chasing after rookie cards. That's why we all had so many Chuck Knoblauch cards in our collection. You know, everybody wanted the hot rookie card. David Justice is another one, and he's included in this set. And David Justice, you know, I remember back in the day, you know, if you pulled a Justice card out, that was $3 or $4. You know, now you can have a dime a dozen for David Justice, who had a pretty good pro career. But you know, the Fleer just totally mismanaged the prospect chase there. So besides that, I think when you look back at this set now, and especially because you can get these cards for so cheap, it's worth taking a flyer on these. I really do think 91 Fleer Ultra is a decent set. It is easy to collect. It is 400 cards. And then you've got the 10-card Fleer Ultra Gold set, or the Ultra Team set, I should say. But, you know, it's only 400 cards. It is chock full of star cards. Like, as I'm opening these packs, and you got 14 cards in a pack, you know, there were some packs where I would get, you know, let's say that Griffey gold card, plus here's a Barry Bonds card, here's a Cal Ripken Jr. card, oh, here's Nolan Ryan. This is all in one pack. So it was loaded with stars, loaded with early career cards of Ken Griffey Jr. and Frank Thomas and, you know, other stars from the mid to late 80s, Roger Clemens and, you know, Roberto Alomar's in there. You know, there's a lot of Hall of Famers in there. And that was a good thing about reducing the size of the set. Instead of rolling out with the 900 card set like Score did, or even, you know, Stadium Club was still a 660 card set, I think, or 600. You know, Fleer Ultra came out with a 400 card set. You only had, depending on the team, anywhere from 13 to 16 cards per team. And that way you kind of knocked out most of the utility players or some of the, you know, fifth arm in the bullpen kind of guys. You basically focused on the star players, the everyday players, the well-known veterans, and then some of the, you know, up-and-coming prospects for the teams. Now, Fleer mentioned in 1991, one of their big marketing points was, and they realized that the hobby was getting into the Husky Pants stage, they realized, well, one good thing to market this is to claim that we are printing a smaller amount of these cards, so there's a little more value to it. They claimed back then that not only was the 400 count set a reason to buy this, but also that they were running Fleer Ultra at a 15% run compared to the base set. Now, on the surface, that sounds pretty good. Well, 15%, there's a little bit of scarcity here. But as we all know, 1991, not only were there millions of sets being produced, but millions of individual cards within these sets. Hence why you can get these boxes for just a few dollars these days, because there are still 8, 9, 10 million of each and every card from a particular set just floating out there. So as I joked in the video break, what's 15% of too much? It's still too much. So while it makes for an easy collecting experience today, you know that there's still some cases of Fleer Ultra floating around from 1991 today. Now, Fleer Ultra would right the ship and rather well in 1992 and 93. They answered the critics by putting out a glossy card, a card that was all photography, a card that featured some top rookies. Like I remember Manny Ramirez was a big hit over the next couple of years. All the big stars were in Fleer Ultra. And the Fleer Ultra sets from 92 and 93, you can still get those boxes dirt cheap and have some really beautiful cards to add to your collection, you know, if you're so inspired to do so. But 91 Fleer Ultra is a set where, and I say this about a lot of the Junk Wax era sets, are you going to get rich off of any of these cards? No. Are you going to, you know, open up some of these packs and see some of these top prospect cards or some of these players like a Kevin Moss who didn't quite pan out? And are you going to groan and go, oh, I remember I used to have 10 of these cards. You know, Eddie Zosky's in this set. I pulled an Eddie Zosky out of a pack and I went, oh, this guy. You know, I mean, we all had that one player that we had 10 cards of and he didn't pan out. So are you going to have those moments? Absolutely. But again, for the why not factor, you know, $4.50 a box. Yeah, why not? And because this set really isn't as bad as it was made out to be back then, this is something where if you have a few extra bucks and you happen to find a box or two at a card show or online, trust me, you can talk down the owner. You can probably, in fact, if you find these on eBay, and, you know, some guy is selling two boxes of Fleer Ultra for $10 plus $14 shipping, I bet you could talk them down to, hey, let me just pay the shipping and I'll take these two boxes. And they'll take it. They just want to get these off their hands. This was a very fun set to reminisce on, a fun time, even though it's frustrating looking back in 1991 and seeing all the glut. Back then, it's still around now. The 1991 baseball cards are the love handles of the Husky Jeans era. You know, we haven't quite totally gotten rid of them. We're trying, but we haven't. You know, there's a little frustration. But again, this was one of those sets where coming back many years later and taking a second look at it, I have a whole new respect for the Fleer Ultra set. And I actually really, really enjoyed opening these up and looking through them and having a whole new appreciation. You know, Fleer really, they tried so hard. This was a good job, good effort, clap back. They really did. But again, the base set was their undoing. The fact that the competition was producing way better premium cards and a couple of miscues on the player selection just doomed Fleer Ultra from the start and kind of pushed it into the dustbin of baseball card history. But it is worth looking at these cards if you get the opportunity. And for just a few dollars a card, why not? Or a few dollars a box, I should say. Definitely not a few dollars a card. You're not going to get any of these cards are going to be valued at more than 25 cents, I would say. All right, let's take a look at some of the stories of players that we selected. Again, I took one card from each pack and selected these players and just some fascinating stories that I found as I was looking through them. First of all, let's start with Terry Mulholland. He was a pitcher for the Phillies in 1991. And Terry Mulholland is a pitcher that often gets overlooked because you look at him statistically, he did not have a great career, but he was a sturdy left-handed pitcher, went back and forth between starter and bullpen. And much like, say, Dan Plesac, because he was able to just get the ball over the plate well enough for many, many years, he is a guy who was able to turn an okay career into a long-term one. He played in the major leagues for 20 years. In fact, 19 years, 360 days between his first major league appearance and last major league appearance. He made his debut in 1986 with the San Francisco Giants, would later play with the Phillies, the Yankees, the Giants again, the Phillies again, the Mariners, the Giants again, the Cubs, the Braves, the Pirates, the Dodgers, the Indians, the Twins, the Diamondbacks. So here's a guy who is not an incredibly gifted pitcher, but had stints good enough as a starter early in his career, and later on was just able to get the ball over the plate as a left-handed specialist, that he was always in need and could always find work, regardless of how good or bad a team was. You could always use a veteran presence in the bullpen, and especially a left-handed presence. But what I remember most about Terry Mulholland was he is often the one starter of the 93 Phillies, that team that got to the World Series and lost to the Blue Jays. That is often overlooked. You know, people remember Curt Schilling in particular with that team, and some of the other pitchers, of course, Mitch Williams, for rather bad reasons, they remember him. But Mulholland was the unsung hero of that rotation, and in fact actually started Game 6 of the 93 series, which of course Williams lost, giving up that home run to Joe Carter at Sky Dome. Now, he also pitched a no-hitter in August of 1990. He was a member of the Phillies and ironically pitched that no-hitter against the San Francisco Giants, his former team, the team that he was most recently with. That was the first time a pitcher pitched a no-hitter against his former team since 1964, when the former Cincinnati Reg, Ken Johnson, did that for the Houston Colt 45s. And by the way, Johnson lost that game 1-0. He is still the only losing pitcher who has pitched a 9-inning no-hitter. So that's an interesting twist of fate there. But Mulholland was able to do that. And like I said, he was able to turn a rather, you know, middling career. You look at his overall numbers, and again, it's just like, eh. But, you know, he was able to hang around for a very long time. Another part of his arsenal that really helped him off, or helped him out, I should say, he had a tremendous pickoff move. You were not safe to take a healthy lead at first base with Mulholland on the mound. So that is something, too, that is often overlooked in an otherwise unspectacular but very productive baseball career. You could say the same thing. Oh, by the way, real quickly, Terry Mulholland, also a big collector in baseball cards, from what I've read. You could say the same thing about Spike Owen, and I picked the Spike Owen card out of this one particular pack because I like the photography. He's at bat, he's in a stance, and there's something about the clarity of the picture of Owen in his Montreal Expos road uniform in this particular set. There's just something that really stands out. And Spike Owen stood out from a very young age, as did his brother Mike Owen, who played briefly for the Chicago Cubs in the mid-80s. Spike Owen would have a longer career, but he stood out even as a youth in Little League growing up in Texas. He was a standout player for the University of Texas, appeared in two College World Series in 1981 and 1982. And very quickly moved up the Seattle Mariners system, made his major league debut in 1983, May of 83. What's interesting about his debut, though, was right before he was called up, the Mariners decided to do a shakeup. They fired Rene Latchman as their manager. They designated a couple players, including Gaylord Perry, for assignment. So he goes into the locker room on this day. It was the Mariners versus the Blue Jays, and he's all excited about making his major league debut, yet it's just a morgue in the locker room because of all of these changes that happened right before his big league debut. But he would have a good debut, as he would go 1-for-4 against the Blue Jays that particular day. Was named the team captain for the Mariners in 1986, and the Mariners thanked him for that captaincy promptly by trading him that August. But it was a very good deal for Spike Owen, as he was part of the infamous Dave Henderson trade from Seattle to Boston. The Mariners not getting a whole lot in return in that deal. Owen would get a chance to play for the World Series for the Red Sox in 1986. He would be a utility infielder for much of the late 80s with the Red Sox, would later move on to Montreal. He was a mentor for Delino DeShields, one of the up-and-coming middle infielders playing second base for the Expos. The Expos had a prospect named Will Cordero, who was coming up into their systems. Owen would sign what was then a lucrative 3-year, $7 million deal, my goodness, with the New York Yankees. Was not a pleasurable experience for him. as he got platooned with Mike Gallego, the Yankees decided to basically eat his contract by trading him to the Angels, where he wrapped up his career after the 1995 season. Now, he would then embark on a very long coaching career. In fact, he was a minor league coach for almost 20 years. Up until now, he is not coaching. He was coaching or managing, I should say, the Hickory Crawdads in the Pirates system as of the 2018 season, but I don't see anything about him working in 2019, but he was very much an influence in the minor leagues and also a mover and shaker in the real estate world of Texas after, managing with Round Rock and some of the minor league teams in Texas and then taking that job with Hickory in North Carolina. He put up his ranch property, a 39-acre property in 2017, asking a mere $10.5 million for it. I don't know if he ever got that money, but good for him on making a good real estate deal. Now, not having a happy ending is Mike Sharperson. And this was a card that I, as I'm flipping through it, I remembered, and I remarked this in the video, I said, one of the great 80s baseball names. And I remember you used to be able to send in doctored baseball cards to Beckett Magazine, and people would take these cards and, draw funny hats or add newspaper clippings to them to kind of make these goofy cards. And I remember somebody took a Mike Sharperson card and basically drew on these really sharp, pointy edges like on his shoulder. So kind of a playoff of the name Sharperson. And I think his nickname for many years was Sharpie. But he was drafted by the Toronto Blue Jays in 1981. In fact, a first-round draft pick, 11th overall, works his way up through the Blue Jays system, is making his debut in 1987, but very quickly is traded to the Los Angeles Dodgers. Well, he wins the World Series with the Dodgers in 1988. He was the ultimate utility platoon guy. He could play numerous positions, mostly in the infield, but also played the occasional outfield, but was a guy that Tommy Lasorda could plug in anywhere. He was one of many players that were known as the stuntmen, which is a rather appropriate Hollywood term. But anywhere that you put Sharperson, he was an adequate fielder. He was a decent hitter. In fact, in 1990, hit 297. He was an All-Star in 1992. The Dodgers were not a very good team, but he did represent them at the All-Star game in San Diego that year. Hit 300 that year, 21 doubles, also scored 48 runs, all career highs. So had certainly hit his peak in 1992. Would get released by the Dodgers heading into the 1994 season. Was bouncing around with minor league deals throughout the next few years, and then signed on as a minor leaguer with the San Diego Padres in 1996. Now, while he was playing for the Las Vegas Stars, which was the top affiliate for the Padres back then, he was driving to the airport in Las Vegas late one night, and it was a rainy night. He missed a turn off of the interstate, I-215. He was trying to go from I-15 to I-215. He missed a turn, tried to correct it, and late at night, wet roads, loses control of the car, and crashes into a ditch, is actually ejected through the car's sunroof, and dies at the age of 34. Such a tragic ending to a career that certainly was not great, but definitely serviceable. Like I said, an all-star, a world champion in 1988, and a guy that could be put into any position, and he would excel more often than not. Now, I don't want to end on a downer, so I found this amazing story. This is very similar to the Tom Nevers story, which I shared during the 92 Upper Deck podcast, where Nevers was a top draft pick of the Houston Astros, but he never played in the major leagues. He was also a draft pick of the Pittsburgh Penguins in, I think it was the 1988 or maybe 89 draft, and he opted not to play hockey. And that's a great shoulda, woulda, coulda, because the Penguins, of course, would win the Stanley Cup in 1991 and 92. And could you imagine Tom Nevers, a top high school player in Minnesota, perhaps playing alongside Mario Lemieux and Jaromir Jagr and all these other great players that the Penguins had in the early to mid-90s. Well, this is a very similar story. It's a young man by the name of Mike York. And Mike York was one of those Fleer Ultra top prospects that you look at and you go, oh, you could have had Jeff Bagwell, but instead you picked Mike York. And I even said while opening the cards up, I said, you know, no offense to Mike York, but he's not quite Juan Gonzalez or Jeff Bagwell. And I'm sure if you told Mike York that today, or even back in 1991, he would say, no offense taken, because in 1991, not only should Mike York not have been on a baseball card, and not only should he not have been playing Major League Baseball, there's a good chance Mike York should have been dead, discarded, in a gutter, in a back alley somewhere, because Mike York was a raging alcoholic throughout the early 1980s. A very talented pitcher, drafted by the New York Yankees in 1982. They give him a $5,000 signing bonus. They send him to Oneonta, New York to start his minor league career. But you're in small town New York. You're an 18-year-old kid. You've got $5,000. You've already got some bad habits. And York is blowing his money on alcohol. Lots and lots of alcohol. And he's getting hurt. So the Yankees released him just a year after drafting him. So the Detroit Tigers decide, oh, let's take a flyer on him. They offer him a contract, but he turns them down. The Chicago White Sox give him a tryout. So he's playing in minor league ball in Sarasota. It's not working out. So he leaves the White Sox and becomes a roofer. Here's a former draft pick who was with the Yankees, perhaps the Tigers if he allowed them, the White Sox. Well, he's putting on roofs. So after putting on roofs on houses for a while and playing some semi-pro ball, he starts getting the itch again. And amazingly for Mike York, the Tigers start coming back around. And it all happens during a semi-pro game. York is pitching against the Tigers, and he's throwing a one-hitter. He's having this incredible game. And the scout that had offered him the contract back in 1983 is at this game, and York recognizes the scout. And during this game, they're negotiating a contract. So when York is not pitching, he's over by the dugout trying to get this contract. So as the story goes, and the story was told via the Chicago Tribune back in, let me see, when was this? 1990. This was shortly after York made his major league debut. He's making these contract negotiations, and at first, the scout offers $500 a month. York says no. Then in the fifth inning, the scout says, we'll give you a $1,000 signing bonus and $700 a month. Take it or leave it. And York says, I'm going to leave it. I can make more as a roofer. The next morning, the scout calls York and says, I'll give you a $1,000 signing bonus and $1,000 a month. So he accepts. And he gets into the Appalachian League, has a pretty good run with Bristol, but then goes to the Florida State League in 1986, gets torched while he's at Lakeland, is dealing with injuries again, and is dealing with alcohol again. And again, the Tigers say, all right, enough, and they release him. So he's down to his last strike, literally and figuratively, and the Pittsburgh Pirates give him a call, and they say, okay, listen, you've got talent. We think you can help us here. We're a young, up-and-coming team, and we need some help in the bullpen. But if you sign with us, you have to go through alcohol counseling with Sam McDowell. Remember, sad Sam McDowell? He was also an alcoholic, drank himself out of the game. But if he would team up with McDowell and clean up his life, the Pirates would give him a chance. So give major credit to Mike York for going, okay, it's time for me to do this. And as he says in the story, I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. So he teams up, rooms with Sam McDowell, goes to Alcoholics Anonymous, gets cleaned up, and eventually works his way up to the major leagues, makes his major league debut, starts in a doubleheader against the Cincinnati Reds, the team that would eventually be the world champion Cincinnati Reds, the team the Pirates would square off against in the NLCS in 1990, has a great major league debut, an iffy few relief performances down the stretch. But the fact is, for a guy who almost drank himself out of the game in 84, 85, probably should not have been alive. Here he is. He's pitching in the major leagues in 1990. Would go on to play for the Cleveland Indians in 1991. Would play in the minor leagues for the next several years. But he would also father a child by the name of Mikey York, who, by the way, is also making his way up through the minor leagues right now. In fact, he was a draft pick of the Tampa Bay Rays in 2016. At last check, is pitching in the Florida State League with the Charlotte Stone Crabs. And looking at his stats right now, he's doing very well. So he is a top prospect in the Tampa Bay Rays farm system. And he's probably still 3 or 4 years away from making it to the big leagues. But this is, again, call it the Larry Cox factor, if you will. Yeah, you know, you look at these cards and you go, oh, I can't believe this guy. Who is this guy? You know, so, you know, whether it's, you know, Larry Cox, the utility catcher slash infielder who died at a tragically young age playing handball or racquetball with his son, or Tom Nevers, who passed on the NHL, who opted to go with Major League Baseball, who never played in the major leagues, but is giving back to the game with youth baseball now. You look at a guy like Mike York, you pull this card out of the pack, and you go, eh, whatever. And, you know, it gets tossed in the commons bin. Mike York is not only lucky to be alive, by all accounts is still sober to this day, so he's probably been going on, 30 years plus with sobriety. And has a son who is doing remarkably well as a minor league pitcher, who also, because he was born and raised in the Las Vegas area, I believe Mike York Sr. settled down in Vegas, but he grew up in the Las Vegas area. He had some contact with Greg Maddux over the years, so that's not exactly a bad person to have contact with if you're a young pitcher. So, you know, don't just scoff at the common cards here. When you go digging deeper, you find some interesting stories. And I'm glad I pulled this Mike York card and did a little digging here, because it's great to see not only did he get clean, not only did he sober up, not only did he resurrect his life and his career, but he has a child who is excelling at that position. And that is just awesome to see, considering, again, 30 years ago, or 35 years ago, I should say, Mike York was almost, going into the trash heap of society. But he was able to, with the help of the Pirates organization, was able to clean himself up, get good and sober, and succeed not only in making it to the major leagues, and having a son who is on a path to the major leagues, but also having a nice little baseball card. And a nice little baseball card set. Again, Fleer Ultra is not going to make you rich. You're not going to be able to pay off your student loans with it. But it is something where if you have a few dollars and you're able to find a box that's cheap or several packs that are cheap, it is a fun, why not, purchase. And yeah, it's really fun to just open up the cards and kind of take a second look at it. I have a whole new respect for Fleer Ultra. It is not the perfect set. It is a set from the bloated Husky Jeans 1991 era of baseball cards. But it is good on its own design. It is good on its own star power, good on its own efforts. It was just a victim to Fleer's other blunders and the higher bar that was set by the competition in 1991. All right, so that'll wrap up our bargain bin dive into the 91 Fleer Ultra set. Again, our next podcast will come your way on May the 10th, so 2 weeks from now. And again, I'm going to focus on a set that I spent a little money on at this recent card show. And I'll talk about the set itself. But again, I'm going to reach out to a person who was influential in this set and I hope I get this person on the phone because I would love to talk about not only the set, but the hobby in the mid to late 70s. Cross your fingers. Hope that we can connect here. If not, we'll at least talk about a pretty fascinating set from a fascinating time in the hobby in our next program. Follow us on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. You'll get some more teases about that particular set in the next few days. And also, don't forget to please make your donations, your cash donations, to paypal.me/waxecstatic. So that we can go out and we can get those fun cards, be it the Junk Wax Era bargain bin boxes or some interesting sets and single cards and packs from days gone by, from many decades ago. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for listening to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next week.